Good evening, everybody. We're going to meet another leader tonight. A band leader this time, one of very few band leaders behind the drum kit. He formed his band 39 years ago in a garage in Los Angeles, together with his friend James Hetfield. They became the biggest metal band in the world, and they still are one of the biggest rock bands worldwide. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome with me the drummer of Metallica, Lars Ulrich.
Am I on?
Come on.
You want me to come up there?
Come here.
Okay. I wasn't going to come up till the candles were lit, but now that the candles are lit...
Have a seat, Lars. Nice to see you.
Thank you for having me. I have just one question before we start. What's the difference between the couches, the red couches here, and the regular seats?
These are VIPs.
You guys are the VIPs. Okay. Don't you feel special right now? Okay. All right. And the candles are lit. And I've got a chair over here. Sorry if I have my back to you. All right.
As we've seen all these old pictures from the old days, what kind of feelings do you have when you see that beside of nostalgia?
Well, you just said 39 years.
Isn't it?
Yes, 39 years. I've been so used in the last year to hearing 38 years, but now since it's 2020, it's 39. We still feel, and I still feel... like we still have the best years ahead of us. It's in Metallica. We like to hear people go, what's your favorite Metallica record? I go, the next one. Because it's always about looking into the future and about trying to better what you're doing and try to come up with new paths and new ideas. But obviously when I see those clips, I guess the main thing I think is how young we were when we started. I started Metallica when I was 17 with James, and a lot of those early clips, when the first couple of records, we made our first record when I was 18. We were touring around the world by the time I was 20. So we started young. That's probably the main thing I think about.
Did you have a certain goal, a clear intention? What do you want to do with Metallica? For example, being faster, playing louder, heavier than Judas Priest and Black Sabbath, than Iron Maiden, or what was the intention?
The main goal at that time was just to have fun. Now you can hear me. Should we start over again? So, the red seats... Oh, you guys are the VIPs. Okay. The main thing in the beginning was to... I wanted to be in a garage cover band. I wanted to play music. I wanted to have fun. I never had any goals about making a career of it, any of that kind of thing. And I think because we started, we were just so enthusiastic. And so we were never... When I came to America, I was born in Copenhagen, Denmark, as you know, and... The oddest thing when I came to America was how everybody were so goal-oriented. What's your goal? What are you going to do with your life? Where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years? I couldn't understand any of that. I just wanted to play music. I was an only child, and so I wanted to be in a gang. I wanted to be in a band, in a collective, in a family, that type of thing. And other than that, I had no specific... We didn't sit there and think that we were going to be... bigger than Judas Priest or Iron Maiden or Black Sabbath or anything like that. We started off as a cover band. And eventually, about 6 months later, we started writing our own songs. And then it just kind of went from there. But the intentions were just to have fun in the garage.
You mentioned Black Sabbath.
Who knows the name of that song? You do? What's the name of the song? That's right. Okay.
Hole in the Sky.
Hole in the Sky, that's right.
Mid-70s, you were 12 years old when that record came out, so you bought it right away.
So when, growing up in Denmark, it's hard to hear you. Growing up in Denmark, I would go to, there was a record store in the center of Copenhagen, and I would bike in there maybe 2-3 times a week. And it was one of those record stores where you could listen to things before you bought it. And so the guy that was working there kind of became a friend of mine and would turn me on to whenever there were new hard rock records that would come out. And I thought he was like the coolest guy in the world. And this guy was, he was kind of my gateway to hard rock music in the 70s in Copenhagen. And, you know, I heard Black Sabbath, I heard Deep Purple, I heard... Sweet, Slade, Status Quo. Those were all the bands I grew up on in sort of 74, 75, 76 when I started listening to harder rock.
You told me in an interview many years ago, backstage at the Howland Studio, and you told me we were complete outsiders at that time.
In what still
way?
Are.
in what way?
The kind of music that we were into and... where we saw ourselves was just so outside of the mainstream. We didn't feel like any of us fit in. We were all kind of misfits, disenfranchised, loners. A lot of us were loners. So when we finally came to San Francisco about a year after we formed, that was the first place where we felt like we were belonging to something that was bigger than ourselves. But when we started the band, James was a loner, I was a loner. And we just wanted to be part of something that was bigger than ourselves.
You came from different social environments. Can I say that?
That we did, yes. Let me confirm that for you, yeah.
You were from Denmark. You came to America.
I grew up in a very sort of artsy, bohemian lifestyle in Copenhagen. Very liberal, very open-minded. My father was a professional tennis player, but his passion was music. He was writing about music, so he would... travel around the world and play tennis tournaments. But when he was in Copenhagen, was at that time in the 1960s, was the capital of jazz music in all of Europe. He would write about all the jazz concerts and write about the music scene. And we will get to that. There was a lot of music around the house when I was growing up, and a lot of art, and a lot of the members of my family were like actors and... so it was a very sort of creative, bohemian, sort of very curious and stimulating upbringing. And then James, who grew up in L.A., grew up very differently than that.
His mother died very early age.
Yeah,
he
grew up in what's called a Christian Science family, which is a religion that don't believe in medicine. So he literally watched his mother... pass in front of his eyes because they would not see doctors. And so he had a very different upbringing than I did.
I just read the biography of Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Maybe you read
sure,
it as well.
Yeah.
And he said Los Angeles in the late 70s, the early 80s, to have all these kids from different social environments out on the streets together, sure. That's gone these days. They're all in separate environments. The rich kids in private schools, the poorer kids in
yeah. But the big thing about LA at that time, and there's still an element of it, but at that time, Los Angeles was the place everybody in America that wanted to become famous, that wanted to make it, whether you were a musician, whether you were an actor, whether you were a writer. Everybody in America went to LA. So LA became this very... this like melting pot of people from all different parts of America, different economic backgrounds and different, obviously, social backgrounds. And it used to be when you were in America, when you were in LA, you would always ask people where they were from. Where are you from? Because nobody in Los Angeles were from Los Angeles. It was kind of crazy. Now you've got second generation, you know, people from there. But at that time, like 95% of the people were literally from other parts of the country, just came to become famous, basically.
And you and James, as you said, and as we all know, you were metalheads. But before you got into metal, you were into glam rock. Who knows it?
You know it? No? Well, you knew the Black Sabbath song. Anybody know what that is? No? Not a single person?
They will.
Seriously? Okay then. Alright, that's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you just Shazam that? You did, didn't you? That's okay.
Actually, okay.
The sweet, okay.
Set so, me free.
Alright, so now we're going to just take a 10-minute music lesson here. No. So that's the Sweet, one of the bands we were talking about that I grew up with. Growing up in Copenhagen at that time, everything came from England. And so most of the television was from England, you know, Coronation Street, Monty Python. Every Saturday we would get the football match from the English First Division, as it was called at that time, not the Premier League. And all the music was basically what was on the hit singles from England: Sweet, Slade, Alvin Stardust, Status Quo, the Bay City Rollers, all that stuff, the Root Bets.
And I said, you were into glam rock, but actually it sounded like a very early version of new wave of British heavy metal, especially this track we were listening
well,
to.
Well, yeah, so I won't bore you with music history here, but the Sweet, there were two sides to the Sweet. They had a lot of hit singles that were written by a songwriting duo that made them really like the number one singles all the time on the pop charts. But then when they wrote their own songs, they wanted to be Deep Purple. And so all the B-sides of their singles and all the deeper album tracks were all sounded like Deep Purple songs, like just that one we just heard.
And as you said before, you were the only son. You didn't have an older brother, a record
nope.
collection of your older sister.
Nope.
Your father brought you into rock music, right?
My what?
Your father, was it, who brought you into rock music?
Well, there was a lot of music around the house. You know, he was playing a lot of jazz music and was playing a lot of Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, The Beatles, and a lot of jazz music, which is what you've got queued up right now. Are you going to Shazam that again? Anybody know what that is? Is that more up your Strasser? Anybody? What? Up your Strasser. Okay, no. Anybody know who that is? That's right.
That's right.
Okay. There you go. So Dexter Gordon.
So let's listen a bit, huh?
Listen. Okay, please.
So that's Dexter Gordon, an American jazz saxophonist, and he was your godfather.
Yes. How the hell did he become my godfather, you ask? Well, he lived in Copenhagen, and a lot of there was a lot of jazz musicians that moved to Copenhagen in the 1960s. Dexter Gordon, Ben Webster, Sonny Rollins spent some time there. And my father, Copenhagen is very small. It's about the size of the stage. And if the people that were in Copenhagen were all sort of hanging out together, and the jazz musicians became good friends of my father, and my father wanted me to have a different kind of godfather, so Dexter Gordon became my godfather.
So as you said before, he was a jazz maniac. He was he was running a jazz club in Copenhagen. He was a journalist. He was a filmmaker, an artist. Yep. He still lives. He's 91 years old.
He's 91 old. Years old, and the first 2 weeks of January just finished. He's recording his new record. I'm not making that up. So I hope I'm still making records when I'm 91. But he still writes. He still paints. He still does art, and he still makes records. And he'll outlive all of us. Well, except Keith Richards, but he'll outlive everybody except Keith Richards.
You know, yesterday night, yes.
That's right.
Give it up for Torben.
Torben, that's right.
Yesterday night, I watched the Metallica movie, Some Kind of Monster, again. Right. And I found it very impressing how honest, how critical, and how precise he was about your work. He is there in the movie two times, I think. Almost like a producer.
Well, yeah, if he was here, sitting here, he wouldn't agree with that. But he's always been brutally honest and has always... him and I have always had an interesting kind of back and forth about music. And I would sit and listen in his room to his jazz records, and he would tell me to listen for certain things or learn how to count to these drum beats or whatever. So he's always had a very, educational element. And so I think the music always, as far as he's concerned, has to have some sort of worth or some sort of value. And if it doesn't, then he'll tell you. And so the part that you're referring to in the movie is when he came in and thought that Metallica had made a song that was not worthy of sharing with the world. So he let me know that in no uncertain ways in front of the cameras and everybody. And that clip made it into stayed in the movie.
And as we said before, he was a professional tennis player.
He was.
He played.
I was trying to think of what tennis players from Switzerland. Does anybody remember Heinz Gundhard? Okay. I think just as Heinz Gundhard was coming up, my dad sort of played up professional tennis up to the mid to late 70s. Yeah.
He's the oldest Davis Cup player in history, age 49. He played for Denmark,
I guess.
Okay.
And the Davis Cup team for many years was him and his brother, and the captain was the father. So it was a very incestuous family situation.
Fantastic. Okay.
Actually, my cousin, who is my father's brother's son, Stein, also was a Danish tennis champion, which leads us to the fact that I am actually the first guy in the Ulrich family that did not become a Danish tennis champion.
Okay.
So I humbly apologize for that.
Did you ever hit a few balls with Roger Federer?
I've had dinner with Roger Federer, but okay. I have not hit tennis balls with him.
Still play tennis, you?
Occasionally. It doesn't amount to much, but when you grow up around the tennis circuit, I don't like to name drop, but there's certain fairly well-known tennis players that when I see them, we play tennis, and it's kind of fun. And when you play tennis from when you were like 2 weeks old, it sort of stays in your blood. So I occasionally play tennis, yes.
And what other sports do you do? Being fit, being healthy is important to survive tours like Metallica tours.
I like to run.
Running.
Run away. No, just run. I like to run and just do workout to kind of keep fit for Metallica. At this age, obviously, 39 years later, the health, the stamina, and everything that comes in the wake of that, good sleep, good food, being responsible for the 2.5 hours up on stage is the primary thing. But I actually really like to run, and I like to run out in nature, not necessarily on a treadmill, and run and listen to the sounds of nature and kind of just be in my own headspace.
I remember that interview, as I mentioned before, at the Hallenstadion many years ago. There was
the Volkshaus.
No, Hallenstadion.
Oh, Hallenstadion.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And,
you know, the first... I don't know if you know this, but the first concert Metallica ever played in Europe was in Zurich.
At the Volkshaus.
Yeah, the Volkshaus in 1984.
Yeah.
That's right. Before most of you were born. That's right.
I just remember that interview, and I was impressed that you had your own masseur. And the yoga teacher was there. I think it's some
don't,
kind of...
Don't tell anybody that.
A Chinese guy, the doctor, or how did you call him?
Huh?
Is he still around?
A holistic doctor. He's He's no longer touring with us. He's actually Kirk Hammett's cousin, our guitar player. And he, but we have a couple of guys that take care of stretching us, and you call them masseuse?
Masseur?
I think they're more like, I think they prefer to use the word personal trainers.
All right.
So they stretch us and they warm us up and they work us out and they make sure that we drink our nasty green protein drinks and stay healthy, all that stuff, yeah.
So where's the rock and roll then?
There's no rock and roll. That's a long time ago.
All right.
That's 20 years ago, at least.
Okay, so...
Now it's green protein drinks and celery sticks and carrots and protein bars. I mean, it's really, really sad, trust me. Really sad.
Okay, you know the Volkshaus, you know the Hallenstadion, you know Heinz Günthert, you know Roger Federer, of course.
I do, yeah.
What else do you know about Switzerland?
About Switzerland?
The
well,
art?
People, it's interesting. I was, when I left San Francisco yesterday, I actually just came here a couple hours ago, but when I left San Francisco, I was speaking to a friend who calls me occasionally. I have the nickname Switzerland because I can be very diplomatic, and I can, I'm the one that sometimes in band arguments or in situations of differences of opinion or discomfort or conflict, I'm the one that often ends up trying to be Switzerland and try to broker peace. Yeah, diplomatic. So I told my friend when I left San Francisco yesterday I was going over to Switzerland to work on my diplomatic skills.
Okay, I got some Swiss music for you. Kind of.
Okay. You don't need to Shazam that, do you? Okay. And does anybody know the Swiss connection on this one?
I think.
Okay. I just checking.
We just listen. So you know the lyrics. We all came down to Montreux.
That's right. On the first concert I ever went to was Deep Purple in 1973. There was a tennis tournament in Copenhagen at the kind of our version of Hallenstadion on a Sunday night, and all the tennis players were invited to come to the Deep Purple concert. The tennis tournament started on Monday. And Deep Purple played Sunday night, so my father took me to see Deep Purple. That was in February 1973.
And would you say that was the initial moment, that was the moment when you knew, that's what I want. I don't want to be a tennis player.
That's a little, it's a little black and white. No, it wasn't quite like that. I actually wanted to, be a tennis player all the way up till I was about 16. We moved to America after I finished school in Denmark. We moved to America for me to, because my dad spent so much time in America. We moved to America so we could spend more time with him and that I could hone my tennis playing skills. But Denmark, like we identified before, is the size of the stage. And I was one of the 10 best tennis players in every age group growing up, 12 and 14 and 16. So when I came to America and we landed in Los Angeles and I wasn't one of the 10 best tennis players on the street that I lived on, and that severely fucked with my head and sort of, I think in the space of 3 months maybe I gave up playing tennis. It was just, this was at the time after John McEnroe and Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg, and every 15-year-old middle-class American child wanted to, or their parents wanted the children to be tennis players. It was way too competitive for me. So rock and roll had been kind of boiling for a few years, and that took over.
So you formed Metallica. You've been a leader since the beginning together with James. Maybe you've heard it. Leaders Wanted, that's the slogan here today. Being a band leader behind the drum kit, one of very few, how did you become that driving force in Metallica? Was that naturally, or have you always been a leader?
It was a couple things. First of all, because James was so introverted and so shy and did not want to... he was very uncomfortable around people, and just Danish people are always about sort of welcoming and embracing and being very sort of hospitable, and so I was always very comfortable with people, and I just ended up, and my mom used to run my father's life. My dad couldn't book a plane ticket or do any of that stuff, so my mom did everything for him. And I guess some of that rubbed off on me. And so when we started the first couple of years with, you know, making demos or sending music to different people or, you know, writing letters or making phone calls to get gigs or any of that, I ended up doing all that. And I don't know if I enjoyed it, but I accepted it. And so later on... I just became that guy that was the sort of the, I guess I don't like the word business guy, but I was the one that would look after Metallica's affairs. And now I'll have to I say that I enjoy it. Because in the business sides of Metallica's existence, there's so many opportunities for creative outlets and collaborations and opportunities that, to me, those opportunities have a creative energy to them also, and that's sort of what turns me on.
So what about James? What about Kirk, Robert? What are their roles in Metallica right now?
Well, their roles are, I mean, obviously the integral part of the music and obviously bigger decision-making things about what we're doing and what direction things are going or whatever we all do together. But I'm the one that ends up being kind of the, I guess, the communicator to all the outside entities that we deal with. And I'm the one that sort of executes the vision of the four of us collectively.
Talking about leadership in a band like Metallica. Talking about leadership.
Yep, leadership.
And, yeah, in a band like Metallica, you called it Monster once, some kind of monster, of course.
I've called it many things over the years.
You have to control it, you have to steer it, you have to feed it. How is that possible?
Well, it's possible to the point that we're still here 39 years later, and it's possible to the point that... in some crazy way and turn of events, we may be connecting with more people than we ever have in our 39th year. We put our last record out in 2016, and that may be... certainly the most successful record we've had in the last 25 years, and the concerts we're playing are seem to continue to be more and more successful. So it's kind of crazy how... with hard rock, there's so many young people still that come. It's almost like a rite of passage when you turn 13 or 14. You have to spend some time with Metallica or Iron Maiden or Guns N' Roses or AC/DC or Black Sabbath or whatever. And it's just amazing how we see this like these new fans. And I think the fans, there's actually more... I think a bigger part of our fans are actually younger now than they were 20 years ago. I think in part because of social media and how social media is kind of connecting us to the fans all over the world. And obviously also because the world is shrinking and the way information travels, we can connect to many more fans all over the world. Like, for instance, Latin America, some of the biggest countries in the world for Metallica are... Brazil, Argentina. We stream more in Mexico than we do any other country in the world. And so I think it's connecting us to more and more younger people also.
I got the impression that every Metallica fan, especially in a band in Metallica, every fan he thinks he owns a part of it. You know what I mean?
They do.
Yeah, like you wrote your first ballad many years ago, Nothing Else Matters, Big Moaning. You did an album with a symphonic orchestra, Big Complaints. You did a band movie, an album with Lou Reed, Shitstorm. Yeah. Must be annoying. Do you ever feel like, shut the fuck up, get your own band?
We're pretty thick-skinned. I mean, ever since we, in 1984, we had a record called Ride the Lightning. It has a song called Fade to Black. And there was an acoustic guitar on that. Can you believe that? Can you believe the betrayal to hard rock? Since 1984, and we started getting a load of shit for that, we've been used to everybody always having... Everybody's got an opinion about Metallica, and we're used to it, and it's fine. We accept it, and we appreciate the fact that everybody's got an opinion. It's much better that everybody's got an opinion than nobody cares.
Of course.
So even if it's negative, as long as you get anything out of people, any kind of emotion is a good thing.
So you became the biggest metal band in the world with the Black Album. After that, at the end of the 90s, you had some very difficult years as well. As we mentioned, the movie, Some Kind of Monster. It was also a very brave decision to release that movie. How difficult was that for you?
Well, thank you. It was a strange year or two. Anybody out there starting businesses or doing groups of people or teams or whatever you run, remember one thing, which is talk to each other and check in with each other, because we woke up after 20 years in Metallica and realized that we had never really talked to each other about how we're feeling and how we are doing and what kind of what the whole ride is doing for us personally. So when we finally sat down after 20 years and checked in with each other, we had a near meltdown. And James, our singer, had to go away for a year and to rehab and get some things in order for himself. And at that time, we were making a new record and we were filming it. So it happened that we were basically filming the meltdown of Metallica just about 20 years ago now. And that became this movie, Some Kind of Monster, which was, I think anything, what turned me on about it was kind of a dare. Metallica has always prided itself in being very transparent and very accessible to the fans and always letting the fans in. And so that movie to me was the ultimate in transparency. It's kind of a crazy thing.
Let's listen to some music around that time, end of the 90s, new millennium, that you gave to me.
I know, yeah. Anybody know what that is? Huh? Okay. You're the guy. You should be up here. You're the guy. Okay. He's the guy. Okay.
So Rage Against the Machine,
yes.
Very important band for you. In what way?
Well, I think they're one of the best bands out there. And I think their music has aged really well. So if you listen to music from 20, 30 years ago, some of it sounds great. Some of it sounds less great. Rage Against the Machine is one of those bands for me that I can keep coming back to over and over again. And their music sounds as vital and as relevant and as timeless as it ever has, even now in these uncertain times and all the craziness that's going on around the world. A band like Rage Against the Machine, I think, is very, very vital in the questions that they raise. And they're actually, as you may know, or maybe these guys know, they're reforming and going out and playing concerts again this spring. And I'm going to go to El Paso for the first show.
Rage.
Will you join me? What? You need to work.
They're not coming over to Europe, right?
They're not coming to Switzerland? No.
No, no.
I don't know yet. They've announced four or five shows.
Yeah, in America.
The big Coachella Festival and a couple warm-up shows in El Paso. So the real Rage Against the Machine fans will be there.
So you also Rage Against the Machine. You have been through such a massive change in music. And having you here at the World Web Forum is also kind of ironic. You were an important figure in the controversy surrounding music sharing, illegal downloads, Napster days, of course.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. But you were one of the first person sounding the horn. But you got shitloads of hate and mockery because of that. How do you think about that now?
Well, like I just said, I have the ability to park things in my brain in places I can't access them. But, you know, it's 20 years ago. It was a strange time. It was a time that we were not necessarily expecting or prepared for. But you have to remember that for us, it started out as a street fight because we've always been very proud of the fact that anything that you get that has the Metallica name on it, it comes from Metallica. And so we were very comfortable sharing things and letting fans tape our concerts. And if you were buying a Metallica T-shirt, it was something that the band members had approved and so on. So basically, we had written a song for a Mission Impossible movie called I Disappear. And we hadn't finished the song yet. It was still being worked on. And all of a sudden, radio stations across America started playing a work-in-progress version of this song. So we're like, well, how did these radio stations get this song? And we traced it back to a company called Napster, who we didn't know who were. And we just literally, I mean, it's infinite stages. And we were like, well, fuck these guys. We're going to, you know, they can't play our song without our permission. Or they can't share our song without our permission. So we just went after them. But it was more like a back alley street fight. And then all of a sudden it turned into a whole thing about digital music and about file sharing and about what role the internet would start playing in entertainment and all that. And we, of course, didn't really see that coming. And all of a sudden I became somewhat inadvertently the poster child for all this. And it was kind of strange because for that whole year, I would get phone call after phone call after phone call from people calling me up and well-known musicians and the biggest stars in the world calling up and supporting me, supporting Metallica. But of course, when I was in public and I looked behind me, there was nobody back there.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of a strange time.
It's interesting. In the rap world, there was, I think, Dr. Dre doing the same thing, like almost the same thing.
He was one of a handful.
But it was the rap music. It's all about the money anyway. But in the metal, it was more like,
well,
stay creepy and poor.
No. For us, it wasn't about money. It was about control. I mean, it was that simple. So if I want to sell a song, I'll sell it. If I want to give a song away, we were happy to give our songs away, but that choice was taken away from us. So it wasn't our choice to give it away. There was a third-party file-sharing site called Napster that gave our songs away. Well, it's like, well, why would you not ask us permission? That was the part we couldn't wrap our heads around. And so it was about control. It really wasn't about money at that time.
And I just always think, if you don't pay the artists, if you don't pay the musicians well, then it's going to be a hobby.
Well, that became a subsequent argument, but I think it's important to note that that's not where it started. So, of course, there's a whole set of economic circumstances that fall in the wake of this. But ultimately, for us, it was about control.
We should never forget that Spotify and Co., they are nothing without the bands.
Well, now all these economic models are set in place, and most of them are functioning very well, and there's a whole system, you know, but it's 20 years later, and it's finally maybe in the last 5 years, and people like Daniel Ek, who runs Spotify, are first and foremost music fans, and so it became clear that there were a lot of people out there that wanted to do the right thing, and Daniel's a friend of mine. Daniel's a friend of Metallica's. And you know, we're very happy with our relationship with Spotify and with Apple Music and with everybody else that we're doing. You know, the most important thing for us is that our fans have access to our music through as many different platforms as possible.
Okay, we are running out of time here.
Already?
Yeah, already.
I just got to Switzerland now.
Someone gave me a note.
Okay.
I would like to end this with my earliest and also strongest Metallica memory. It was around 1986. I was 15, I think. I was sitting on the floor in the living room of my friend's house. Parents were away.
What?
And then we were putting on this Master of Puppets album. And it started with that Spanish guitar. And yeah, you know which one
acoustic
it is.
Acoustic nonetheless, yeah.
There's this refrain, "Cannot kill the family, battery is found in me." I read this as a statement for the metal family in Los Angeles, but there are some people saying it's a war metaphor. What is it?
If James was sitting here with you, he would tell you that he doesn't like to explain his lyrics, and I think that the best lyrics and the best songs are the ones where you lose yourself and you make your own version of what that song means, and the place it transports you to is your own journey, your own destination. This is a wide open thing for everybody. So a song like Battery really is about just, again, like I've said multiple times, kind of belonging to a bigger family and feeling that you have a sense of purpose and that you have a home somewhere. And whether that's at a Metallica concert or in a mosh pit or whatever you want Battery to mean.
We know now which is my favorite Metallica album. Do you have a favorite Metallica album?
I told you the answer already. My favorite album, Metallica album, is the next one. Because we always... That's right. You always have to look ahead. And coming back to Switzerland and playing more concerts and making more records and all the rest of it. So we're just getting started. 39 years. It's just... If we keep going at this rate, we actually may be a record deal in our future. So... We may actually do this professionally at some point. You got that to look forward to.
So I think that's the perfect end of this show. It was a pleasure talking to you. Check us out on the internet, soundtrackofyourlife.ch. And thanks, Lars, for
sharing
the soundtrack of your life with us.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lars Ulrich.
Thank you.
Thank you.